welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show each week and also founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity. At Yes to Life, we feel that the diagnosis of cancer is a lot more than a physical issue needing some surgery or some drugs. It's a major crisis for most people, challenging them at every level and requiring a huge range of supportive measures. Integrative medicine is all about acknowledging the support that's needed and constantly looking for better ways to provide it. One of the resources that's grown exponentially in popularity in many walks of life, including cancer, is mindfulness. And my guest today, Casey Sheen, is someone who's found it central to her own well-being and has also worked to promote its benefits to others. Hi, Katie, delighted to have you as my guest on the Yes to Life show.
Well, delighted to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a real honour.
So. Great stuff. So you've been engaged in mindfulness as part of your own personal inquiry into life for something like 25 years, I think. And along the way, you've been grateful for your familiarity with the practice when you find yourself in some very tough situations, the toughest of which possibly was your own diagnosis and treatment of cancer.
Yeah.
So you're in a position to speak not only of the practice and all its merits, but also to share your real world experience of how it helped you in situations that many of our listeners have faced or will face. So the first thing I wanted to ask you is what drew you to look into mindfulness in the very first place?
Because I was suffering a lot in everyday life. I was finding life difficult. I didn't feel as though I had a good way of managing my strong emotions and of managing challenges in my life. And in fact, the thing that brought me to it the first time wasn't my own cancer journey. It was the cancer diagnosis of my sister's husband, Paul Chamberlain. Mm-hmm. So he was diagnosed with a low-grade glioma back in 2000, actually. He was only 30 years old. My sister was a couple of months pregnant with their second child. And like, what do you do with that?
Mm.
You know, how do you get up each day? How do you manage? As it unfolded, we realized that it was going to be terminal. And he passed away when he was only 35. And, brain cancer is such a tough
brutal, drug. Brutal.
It's absolutely brutal. And it was frontal lobe. So we kind of lost the real Paul about 2 years before he actually passed away. It was so hard, so hard. And I wanted to be there for my sister and her children. And Paul, of course, he was, I was really close to Paul as a wonderful guy. And I didn't know how to be there for them. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to manage my own emotions. And I was brought up in the Christian faith. And that seemed to be saying, with apologies to those that have a much deeper understanding of the Christian faith, it seemed to be saying, put your trust in God. And that wasn't something that I could apply to, yes, but how do I get up today?
Mm.
How do I contribute? So that's what brought me to mindfulness, was a way of managing that very first experience of cancer that our family had. Yeah.
Mm. Can you remember what it was about mindfulness that made you think, oh, maybe this will help?
I saw Buddhist monks, and they always seemed so peaceful and also so joyful. You know, they're so quick to smile and they just had this relaxed vibe about them. And I knew that they were just people like me. And I was intrigued by how a normal person could reach that kind of state. What was it that they knew that I didn't know? So that's what made me pick up a mindfulness book. And in those days, as you say, it was a long time ago now, there wasn't secular mindfulness in the UK like there is now. There are some fabulous secular resources here now, which I think are just tremendous. But at the time, my only way into it was through Buddhism. So I picked up a Zen Buddhist book, read it, and honestly, it was like a light going on. I just never thought of life like that before.
Mm.
So I spent a number of years exploring different Buddhist traditions, but they always kind of got to the point where they felt too much like a religion and therefore just didn't sit with me. You know, this kind of chanting and candles and, I'm, white, Western, British, my cultural heritage is very different, and it felt, just didn't feel comfortable for me. But actually what I then found was the Plum Village tradition, which is Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh. So it's traditionally it comes from a Vietnamese Zen tradition, but Thich Nhat Hanh came to the West and his life was saying, well, how do I take what I know from my Vietnamese Buddhist background and make it applicable to people in the West, which was just what I was looking for, because suddenly here was an incredible mindfulness teacher with this real depth of knowledge of the original teachings, but who could make it relevant to my life. And that was the missing link for me to get from, I could tell there was great wisdom in the Buddhist teachings, but I couldn't quite find my way through. I obviously didn't have that level of understanding. So that's been a bridge to me. And obviously over the years as well, there have been tremendous Western mindfulness teachers who've done the same kind of thing. You know, they've gone and studied in Buddhist monasteries in the East and then brought it back and said, right, this is how it applies to us. So, very grateful for all of those amazing people that have kind of translated mindfulness, if you like, into something that feels relevant to me and in my home in Stockport, South Manchester, you know.
Great. Okay, so as I mentioned, you encountered a diagnosis of cancer yourself. At this point, you've been engaged in mindfulness probably for more than a decade. How central was mindfulness to your life by then? And did your relationship to mindfulness change as a result of meeting the existential challenge of cancer?
Great question. So yes, it was very central in my life by then. As I say, I'd been exploring different Buddhist traditions by then. By then, I'd found Plum Village. They offer hundreds of what are called sanghas. So these are groups of people of all faiths or none who meet together regularly to practice mindfulness. And I've been attending a sangha for nearly a year in that tradition. It was very integrated into my life. And I'm really grateful for that, because when life is going well, some of these teachings can be quite intellectual. You know, you can understand the concept. You can understand the principles. But when you move into a situation where, as you say, you're faced with these existential questions as a very real felt experience, it was intriguing to see how I reacted to that. And I was so grateful as I was diagnosed with cancer, which was through a colonoscopy, and they had the screen turned towards me. And so I saw on the screen, it was a type of tumor that kind of eats into you rather than actually forming a lump. So there was this open wound with little nodules around it that were bleeding. And there was this moment where there was a missed beat in the conversation where the consultant just kind of took a breath. It had all been quite chatty up till then. And in that moment, instinctively, my mind just went back to finding the breath in my body, of the gentle rise and fall of my body as I was breathing. And that was a real moment, because in the shock, it was instinctive to search for that comfort. And so the fact that I've been practicing mindfulness a long time, and the first thing that I did in terms of settling myself was to come back to my breath, was really, a really profound realization and a great deal of gratitude for all of those hours that I had spent playing with that and experimenting with it. And I think a real reflection of how that does become a source of comfort. You know, it's with anything, it starts as a practice and it feels a bit odd to find the breath in the body. And you think, why on earth am I doing that? Well, the body is always in the present moment and my breath is going to be there until I take my last breath. So it means that it helps me to move inwards. And then there's I don't know if you've ever noticed, but if you breathe in and breathe out, there's then a pause before your body takes the next breath. And in that pause, there's this incredibly peaceful place where everything just kind of stops for a moment. And there's this sense of clarity and peacefulness. And so that's what my mind was looking for, because the shock, obviously, you know, there's a moment of like, whoa, I just have no idea what to make of this. And in that space between the breaths, you can just rest and regroup. And that was what my mind did. And then moving forwards, yeah, it was very much a case of, well, this is how I'm feeling and what part of my practice feels relevant for that. And there were obviously multiple moments of like, oh, this is how it really works.
Right. So very interesting. I mean, that's kind of the rubber hitting the road, if you like, that diagnosis moment where you've done all this practice and everything, and actually you've practiced sufficiently or in sufficient depth that it obviously it had become part of your being, a natural response to a situation rather than a worked out strategy, you know. And so, yeah, very interesting. And yeah, I can imagine you were very grateful to have it in that intense moment.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was wondering whether you'd mind telling us, just flesh it out, your story about your cancer, your diagnosis, and how everything went, and how mindfulness has played into that story all the way through.
Yeah, of course. I guess the main spoiler alert is that I'm still here.
We noticed.
Yes, you noticed. And I know it sounds silly, but it's like, you know, cancer inspires such a lot of fear that to actually say out loud, I survived. Mm-hmm. So hopefully people who are listening now, and both you and I, can kind of, there's something that happens in our nervous system when we consciously say, I survived, like happy ending, it's all okay. That enables the stress response to drop, and then we can hear more clearly and we can discuss this now. So it all turns out well. I've been clear for a number of years now.
Can you just tell me what the prognosis was at the beginning?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with stage 2 anal cancer, which is a very rare form of cancer. Stages 3 and 4 are very, very difficult to treat, and the prognosis isn't good. But, you know, it's treatments are improving all the time, and I know people that are still thriving with stage 3 and 4. But stage 2, I was incredibly lucky. It meant that it hadn't moved into the lymph nodes. And so my chances of survival, depending on who I spoke to, were between 60 and 80%. So still not enough to kind of relax, and I was going to say enjoy the ride as much as anyone can do. But I mean, it is amazing, isn't it, how we do have the kind of treatments that sometimes cancer is discovered and then it's treated and it's gone. I mean, that's astonishing, really, isn't it? Even though it takes a long time for our nervous system to catch up with that. And certainly in my own case, you know, there is definitely residual fear. It was very traumatic. So from the point of diagnosis, which was 4th of November 2014, I was treated in March, April 2015. And it was a year after that before I knew that the treatment had worked. So there was, you know, sort of well over a year of not knowing whether or not it would work. So mindfulness, I think one of the key things it helped with was managing thoughts and emotions. Because what mindfulness helps me to do is when a strong emotion arises, and boy, there are so many strong emotions during the cancer journey. And, you know, I remember many instances where I was absolutely terrified. But it enabled me to go, well, yeah, you're terrified, Kate. And that feels like a reasonable response right now. You know, I mean, when else are you going to feel frightened? I mean, how bad do you want life to be? How difficult do you want life to be before we allow ourselves to be frightened? And that turning towards ourselves with kindness and care and compassion, like a best friend, that's the whole self-compassion side of mindfulness, which is utterly transformative. UK
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Allowing myself to be frightened, it gives that little bit of space. When you admit, yeah, this is really hard, it opens the door to then taking care of yourself, to taking actions to comfort yourself. And that might be something as simple as, I just need to look out the windows and watch the birds for a little while now, or I need to make myself a cup of tea. Or, actually, I'm really concerned about this aspect of my treatment and I need more information. I need to phone my treatment team, my medical team. I need to get in place exercise and nutrition and all the other things. And I mean, I'm very lucky. I have an amazing, amazing family and awesome network of friends. And there's also allowing yourself to be vulnerable is part of that self-compassion, you know, being brave enough to reach out to the people around you and say, you know what, I am really struggling. I really need your support right now. And also to have thought about, okay, well, what is it that people could do to help me? Because I think that's a bit confusing both for patients and carers, because sometimes, you know, it would be great, wouldn't it, if there was a magic wand and you can make cancer go away. So there's also that specific thing about, how could I be kinder to myself? How could I take care of myself? How could I take the pressure off? What would really help? And so mindfulness enabled me to just take that little bit of a step back into the role of my own best friend and to look more deeply and more calmly at those practical ways that I could help myself. So, for example, I used hyperbaric oxygen therapy to help my recovery because I had very bad nerve damage afterwards. So I had to go back and kind of fill in the gaps, as you're asking. I had 28 sessions of pelvic radiotherapy and two rounds of chemotherapy through PICC line, you know, where they put it in and you have the chemotherapy bag strapped to you for 6 days at a time. That was at the beginning of the radiotherapy and towards the end. And as is unfortunately quite common in treatment for anal cancer, or it was at that time anyway, I think it's improved now as thankfully everything moves forward. It was very common to have skin damage, and the skin damage was so bad that I spent 13 days as an inpatient in the burns unit in my local hospital. And I went from being a confident public speaker to so traumatized that I couldn't go into public spaces without feeling panicked. Very, very unsafe. And physically, I was living with really extreme chronic pain for over a year, extreme to the point of it would wake me up in the middle of the night. and often bring me to my knees, which I used to think was just a poetic phrase, brought to your knees, my pain. But no, that's real. And having the calmness in those moments to know that everything is impermanent, which is a big teaching in mindfulness, is that everything is flowing and changing all the time. And if in those moments all I could do was sink to my knees and lie on the floor of my bedroom for a while, just feeling the confidence that this will not last forever. And if I just calmly wait here, let my body breathe, let my nervous system settle, I will be able to get up and, you know, move on with the next moment of the day. So living life moment by moment is something that I found really valuable. You know, we hear that, don't we, as a soundbite of mindfulness.
We do.
Being in the moment, and you think, yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah, sounds good. But in those kind of extreme situations, I think it's invaluable, because if you get through life one moment at a time, then the next moment is going to be different. And it was amazing, actually, the number of times where I would wake up feeling dreadful, and actually half an hour later, I'd be feeling better, you know. And so knowing that in this moment I feel awful, so I'm just going to rest. And then in the moment where I feel better, thinking, right, now I can get up and have a shower. There's a freedom in that.
Absolutely. Yeah. That whole thing really strikes me quite often as it, anybody who's had kids knows that they fall over and, you know, graze their knee, all hell lets loose, the world is in a mess. That once they've had it cleaned out, had the pink plaster on there, little kiss, all the rest of it, it's like, bam, done. They've got their attention on the next thing, you know. Their mind and their expectations doesn't play into it in the same way that it does with that. Oh, this really hurts, going to, you know, keep me awake tonight. Or, you know, we have all these future thoughts about what's going to happen as a result of what's just occurred. Or what we're experiencing now is so bad that, you know, I can't stand this. And it's just going on and on. We have all those kind of thoughts, which, and I don't think we realize how much we perpetuate our own suffering with those things. I think we're quite unaware of it. But children, of course, they don't even have a concept of that. And they're just in the moment with whatever's happening. And yeah, they don't get tied down by pain and suffering in the same way.
Yeah, that's really valuable. That's a beautiful way of explaining it, is our thoughts and perceptions add to it. So in mindfulness, there's a concept of first and second arrow. You know, if somebody fires an arrow at you,
right,
the best thing to do is take the arrow out. Whereas what we tend to do is think, who fired that arrow? And oh my goodness, what will happen? You know, we make a massive fuss and drama about it instead of just thinking, you know what, I just need to take this arrow out. And there's a great way of explaining it in secular mindfulness as well, which is that it's a bit like the difference between having a video camera on a situation. So a video camera will just show you what's happening. But obviously what we do is we look through the lens and then we create a story around what's happening.
Right.
And it's the story that, as you so rightly said, contributes hugely to our suffering. So a lot of mindfulness is noticing when we're caught in the stories and those beliefs and perceptions that you explained there so well, and helping us to say, hang on a minute, I'm caught in my thoughts, past and future. How do I get out of that? And so you come back into the present moment. And there's a really nice analogy as well, which is that there are seeds of every emotion within us. And it depends which ones we water and feed as to which ones grow strongest. So if my thoughts are always feeding my fear or my anger or my resentment or my jealousy, that's going to become a really powerful emotion. But if we decide, hang on a minute, I'm going down the wrong path here, and I choose a different direction, and then you kind of pick up your thoughts and you place them somewhere else, and then you nourish that particular seed. And there's another little story, actually, that hopefully some listeners may find useful, is I used to think that I would only be happy if I was well, if I had a perfect relationship, perfect job, car, blah, blah, blah. There were all of these conditions for happiness. And it was only when I ticked all the boxes could I finally be happy.
Right.
And that was really what brought me to that. You remember that first Zen book I mentioned that I read? It talks about happiness being like a butterfly. Is that if you sit calmly, the butterfly will come and fly around and then it will go again. And if you grasp it, you'll obviously damage it. But the more peacefully you sit and just wait for the butterfly to come back, it will come back. But in other words, happiness isn't a constant state. I mean, that's not realistic as a human being. You know, all of our feelings ebb and flow all the time. But if I relax about that and just know that happiness will come and go, I can stop grasping it quite so much. And then to go back to the cancer story itself, a few weeks after the treatment, I was lying on my sofa looking out the window, and my boyfriend, bless him, had moved the bird feeder so that I could see it from the front window. And I was watching, and there were some little colourful birds came down. I thought, oh, how lovely, how exciting. And it was a real moment of happiness. And I thought, well, that is intriguing, because actually I'm feeling absolutely rubbish today.
That's great. It's so amazing that idea that things can be superficially wrong in many ways, but you can actually still be happy in the moment. It's astonishing, isn't it? And I think our ideas about it can be so strong. My daughter died, as you may know, and I remember in the weeks afterwards, there were, you know, things would come and go. Obviously, life went on, and the good things happen, bad things happen. Sometimes you feel something's funny, sometimes you feel something's nice, whatever it is. And there can be a voice out there saying, wait a minute, you shouldn't feel like this. You know, and I resolved just to ignore it at the time. But I could see how powerful it was, the idea of how I should be because of the situation I was in. And it wasn't like that, in fact. I mean, it was like that. I was absolutely distraught as well. But, you know, it was just the usual life mix, actually, of things coming and going. And if you left it alone, I think, you know, leaving it alone is the quickest path back to some kind of normality or, you know, reasonable life, away from the highs and lows of experience that come straight after an event like that. But anyway, very interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, you explain it beautifully. It's intriguing how much guilt we can have around feeling happy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I remember once there was a meditation. There are some wonderful meditations called metta or loving kindness, where you wish yourself well. And one of the wording, one of the little phrases was, may things go well for me. And I thought, do you know what? I'm over 50. I don't think I've ever thought that. And it's just like, wow, Kate, you know, because whenever something is coming up, I'm thinking about, it's more anxious thoughts. How can I not make a mistake? How can I,
right,
you know, but to actually think, to say those words to myself, Kate, you know what? Really hope this goes well for you. I'd say it to a best friend. I'd say it to my children, my family,
right,
everybody else. But I wouldn't actually use that phrase as part of my internal dialogue.
Yeah. That's kind of in line with the self-compassion you were talking about, actually, is treating yourself like anybody else.
Yes, absolutely. Because,
yeah.
And that's why these kind of teachings, the mindfulness teachings, are so simple and they're so obvious. When every time I hear them, I'm like, oh, yes, why have I never seen it like that before? But that idea of actually being kind to ourselves in that way, you know, if we were dressing a child, you know, you dress them carefully and there's a bit of chat about, you know, do you want these socks and this top and put your coat on, it's cold outside. But for ourselves, we're usually thinking about what's going ahead or what will people think of me when I dress like this?
Yes.
Self-judgment.
Yeah.
But there is that sense of, yeah, but what do you want? And I think some of us, very much myself including that, I think at times I've lost sight of myself in my life.
Yeah. Sure, I can say that too.
What do I want? What does make me happy?
Mm.
And those are really important questions to ask, you know.
Agreed.
How can I have a happy life if I've never really thought about what makes me happy in the present moment. So that's the place to look again, is where do I see those little flickers of happiness and how can I focus on them and enjoy them more, you know, because they're very fleeting sometimes.
Yeah. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
We've been talking about mindfulness. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about the practice of mindfulness. All right. And I even thought, can we do a little bit on the radio here? Could you do a little session with us now? Just a minute or two of a guided mindfulness?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think probably the most valuable one for everyone is just the basic practice of anchoring ourselves in the present moment. So wherever you're listening at the moment, you don't have to stop and sit down and close your eyes. This is something that we can do at any moment of the day. So first of all, just kind of bringing your awareness inwards to ask yourself, how am I? How am I feeling? And straight away, you might find some tension in your body. And so automatically, can you release that bit of tension? And if you're feeling anxious, you can think, yeah, I wonder what it is that I could do to make myself less anxious. Maybe there's something that springs to mind. But if your thoughts are very tumultuous, then it's simply a case of, well, can you feel your body in this present moment? Can you feel your feet on the floor? Okay, so wriggling your toes, that always makes me smile and kind of release. There's something really delightful about toe wriggling and imagining yourself on a beach. But, you know, I'm wriggling my toes now and I can feel the warmth of my socks and I'm wearing slippers because I'm inside, which are great to wear. And immediately my mind is going to things that are pleasant, which automatically makes me feel calmer and safer and steadier. And as I'm wriggling my feet, I'm then aware because I'm sitting on a chair, I can feel the pressure between my thighs and where I'm sitting. So wherever you are listening to this, I mean, maybe you can reach out and touch something. You know, even if that's just your hands on your thighs or whether it's the table that you're sitting at or the mug of tea that you're holding. So what can you sense? And how does that make you feel comforted? Can you actually tune into that sense of being comforted? So can you allow the chair to support you? Can you allow the floor to support you? Will you accept the support it offers and really relax down into that? And if you do have a drink with you, can you take a sip? And how does it taste? And thinking about where the water's come from. You know, I mean, that water has been around since prehistoric times, so, you know, since the beginning of our planet. And incredible to think that the water that we drink has been inside plants, animals, it's been in a cloud, it's been rain, ice, sleet, snow. You know, it's been all of these different things, and now it's been beautifully purified and is safe to drink. And as we drink it, it becomes part of every cell. And that feeling of being inextricably part of everything, you know, the solidity of mountains, of plains, of forests, of the beautiful flowers around us, makes us hopefully feel less alone, more connected. You know, we are made of molecules that were once something else, and they're moving through us. These molecules are me at the moment, but they won't be me in the future. They'll be something else. So, you know, so we're a kind of a rising from everything else and becoming us for a while, and then just moving back into other forms all the time. I find that not just a concept, but a practice, you know, of actually becoming aware of that in each present moment. You know, in each moment there are these things that we can feel and see and hear and taste and touch that show us how connected we are. And especially when we link into things that make us feel safe and comfortable. So when you look around you now, can you see things that you've chosen, if you're at home, to be around you? There's maybe photographs, or I can see ornaments and I know who bought them for me and what the significance is. And when I think about it, when I become present for that ornament, I can become present for the love that lies behind it, for the connection, for the significance. It helps me to, yeah, feel more safe and secure. And being able to do that wherever you are, in whatever moment, come out of thinking and out and into sensing, using that physical presence, is more of a practice than a concept. Does that make sense? It's a felt experience of settling, of comforting, of being part of something.
Great. Thank you for that. Thank you. So I wanted to ask, on the one hand, mindfulness seems to be something that's very much between me and myself, about my relationship to my experience. But you've already talked about mindfulness with a group of people, and you've just been talking about connection. Can you just talk about mindfulness in these two contexts, of like your own practice and mindfulness in relationship to others?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, we begin with ourselves, because the more peaceful I am, basically the nicer I am to be around. You know, if I'm caught in my own thoughts and worries, I'm not present for other people. So I'm not as good a friend. I'm not as good a mother or a daughter or a sister. Because I think we've all had experience of this. You can talk to someone and you can just tell that they are caught in their thinking. They're not here. And also, it's very difficult to reach people, you know, and we all care about each other. And if I can take care of myself, that will support people around me, you know, because I think one of the things that's difficult is people say, oh, well, I didn't tell you that, I didn't want to worry you. Wow, okay. Need to look at my worry levels then in that case, because actually I want to be the kind of person that you can come to and tell me anything, knowing that I am peaceful and calm enough to handle whatever you bring to me. I think that makes me a better friend, you know, relative. And so we begin with ourselves, which going back to Thich Nhat Hanh is the paraphrasing, because he would have put it much more beautifully than this, but there is no point being an angry peace campaigner.
That's good. I like that.
Absolutely. And so if we want to see peace in the world, we have to be peace. We have to model peace. And so even though we begin with practicing with ourselves, in mindfulness, we're doing it for the benefit of everyone else as well. We're doing it so that we can show up in the world in a more constructive way. More peaceful way. And peaceful doesn't always mean going along with everything. If you think of somebody, the great civil rights campaigners, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, those kind of people, and certainly Thich Nhat Hanh was like this as well, is that the thing that made people listen to them was this kind of peaceful, calm, but very powerful inner strength. And it's that inner strength that I think sometimes gets missed in mindfulness. I think when I came to it, I thought it was really just about being calm. And calm isn't necessarily something in those days that I would have linked to strength, whereas what I've seen is it's the peaceful inner strength. And when you meet monastics who are really, and lay people who practice really powerfully, they're just so steady and stable. Just amazing to be around that kind of person, because I then can feed off that energy, as well as asking them, well, what are you doing?
What's your secret?
What are you doing? And I've got a fabulous mentor called Dean Donalds, and other fabulous mentors as well. But Dean was the one that said to me, so he does a lot of work in prisons, so very, very challenging environment. I said, Dean, what do you do on a day when you're going to go into prison? And he just said, I sit for longer. And I just thought, yeah, that's brilliant. Because what he's doing is he's just making sure that he is so stable that he can go into that kind of challenging environment, and he brings stability in. And that gives everyone else something to become stable around. And that's nothing to do with what he says. It's in his presence.
No, to a being,
it's a state of being. So that's what we're heading for in our mindfulness practice. And it's definitely known as a path, because I'm not sure that any of us ever quite get there. We all have our moments, and definitely, knowing that it's a path, though, gives us the permission to lose our way. And then we think, oh, hang on, I'm losing the plot a bit here. And then there's a path to come back to through the practices, and we know what we're heading for. And there are these very definite practices, a bit like the one we just did but I'm losing the way. Okay, so let me come into the present moment, connect to where I am, steady myself. And the reason that we are calming and steadying ourselves is so that we can see life more clearly. And then when we can see life more clearly, now we can make a more rational decision about what to do next, what action to take. So mindfulness is very much about engaging with the world, because there's no point sitting for 10 minutes every morning listening to a meditation and thinking, right, I've calmed down for 10 minutes. And then you just get up and carry on as
you're right. Business as usual. It's relevance to your real life.
Yeah, absolutely. But what you can learn through meditation is it's sometimes easier to just sit still for a minute and think, right, I'm just going to sit still. And actually, it's easier if I close my eyes to feel my feet on the floor, to be aware of the sounds, to release the tension in my body. Just closing eyes is like closing one of the sense doors, obviously, because you're not being distracted by what you can see. And so mindfulness is a way of practicing, oh, my mind is all over the place. Can I just give it the opportunity to rest now? It's a bit like when you shake up a snow globe. There's bits
of yeah.
And you can't see what's in the middle of it. And that's often how life feels. But if you want a snow globe to settle, what do? You just place it on something that is stable and wait. And then the snow settles. And that is how meditation should feel, is that you just, I just need to stop. I'm just going to sit here and I'm just going to let all of my thoughts settle like snow. And in fact, there's a beautiful poem by one of the first Buddhist nuns that was written 2,600 years ago, or more, a little more than that now, which talks about allowing your thoughts to settle like snow on warm ground. And I find that, you know, so meditation should never feel like a struggle. It should feel joyful. It should feel that in that moment, you're just allowing everything to settle. Just allowing it to settle. And then you can choose a meditation that has certain words. One of the ones I used a lot was just being aware of my toes, smiling to my toes. And then you work through your body, smiling to every point of my body. And I remember I came to my left knee and thought, I'm not smiling at my left knee. Because there was a long-standing injury there. And I thought, well, that's intriguing. If I'm walking around, moving around my whole life, not liking my left knee, that's bound to have some kind of negative effect on my life. And obviously then when I was diagnosed with cancer, it was really important that I was able to look at where the cancer was in my body, using my imagination, and to actually see that those cells were struggling, you know, because they were internal and I'd seen that they were bleeding. And that kind of made it easier because I could see, well, those cells are really suffering. You know, my body really wants to be well, and we are in this together. It's not that my body had betrayed me or, you know, was setting out to destroy me. It was struggling.
Those are tough concepts to get over. Some people suffer a lot from that kind of thing, don't they?
Absolutely.
And they're societal ideas, unfortunately. They get passed around.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Well, yeah, thanks. That question went a long way. So thanks very much. That was great. We're actually out of time. And this is one of those interviews where I haven't asked you half the things I thought I might. But
all right.
That's quite all right. It's been really good. It's been really interesting. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people have appreciated what you had to share. Do you want to just quickly say where people might go next? Next steps for somebody who's been inspired by what you said?
Everyone is welcome to reach out to me. If you just Google Katie Sheen Mindfulness, you'll find me and my website. And if there are specific questions, then, you know, all my contact details are there and, you know, social media and all that malarkey. Everybody's way into mindfulness is quite individual. There are lots of great mindfulness teachers out there. I think a big part of it is finding someone whose voice you find comforting. And of course, the words and the kind of things that they're talking about. So if self-compassion is the thing today that's really touched your heart, then maybe somebody like Kristin Neff or Chris Germer would be people to turn to. If you're more of a science-based person, then somebody like Rick Hansen, who's a neuroscientist, his way of approaching mindfulness is much more scientific. There's the Oxford Centre for Mindfulness in the UK, which put out they've got a really great app, and that is secular. That may well resonate with people. I'm trained as a Breathworks teacher. They're a Manchester-based charity. They offer 8-week mindfulness courses in health and stress. And that is a course which is specifically around managing pain, chronic pain and chronic fatigue and so on and so forth, which is why I trained in that one. That's a terrific course. Again, secular one. My own practice, as I've mentioned, is founded in Plum Village. You know, there is a free app for Plum Village. There's a huge range of voices on there of different nationalities, different cultural heritages. And that's where I feel most comfortable. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's right for other people. So my suggestion would be to move around all of the resources that feel safe. And if you don't like the voice and you don't like the tone, then don't move away from mindfulness. Just keep looking for a teacher.
Move on.
Yeah, move on. Yeah. Find a teacher that resonates with you.
Yeah. Marvelous. Lots of resources. Thank you very much. That's brilliant. Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you so much, Katie, for a great chat.
Yeah, it's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you so much. And sending love to everyone who's listening. Take care.
Thank you.
Take care, Robin.
Bye-bye. Do take a look at some of those resources that Katie just laid out for you and respond to her invitation to contact her if you think, after listening today, that mindfulness could play a part in your ongoing well-being. Thanks so much for listening today. I'll be back again next week with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. So please do join me again if you can. Goodbye.